welcome to the Dr. Drew podcast. All the usual stuff, of course. Support those that support us. Keep the wind in the sails of the Corolla pirate ship. Don't forget those swinging sounds. And do click through on the Amazon banner. It doesn't cost you a thing, but helps us keep this thing afloat, as well as supporting those that do support the pod. We appreciate it very, very much. We try to very carefully select the people that we get behind us, and I hope you'll support them. Today, I'm welcoming Erica Sandberg. Her podcast is Adventures with Money. It's available on Stitcher. Her book is Expecting Money, The Essential Financial Plan for New and Growing Families. ErikaSandberg.com is where you can find her. Erica, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Now, one of the reasons I brought you in here was, I think, did I hear you on Econ Talk or something like that?
Yes.
Okay. So I heard you on Econ Talk, and you were talking about homelessness, and you talked about it in a way that was so honest. And we can talk about all the other financial issues as well, as pertains to your current book and podcast and whatnot. But I want to start with the homelessness thing, because you were talking about it so honestly and from such a place of experience and with such a clarity that I never hear, and it drives me insane. So if you don't mind, I want to start with that.
Oh, my God, absolutely. And it drives me insane, too. So it's nice to have two sane people talking about it. We desperately need it.
Yes. So one of the things, for instance, you said is that although we all feel terrible when we see somebody in need, we want to give them food because we don't want to give them money, because we figure that's going to be something they use for drugs or alcohol. But food ends up being one of the bigger problems, does it not?
Well, yeah. I mean, absolutely. It's interesting. I'm in San Francisco. In Los Angeles, and in fact, the greater California, the problem of homelessness is escalating dramatically.
Yeah.
But food is not one of the problems that we have. Actually, there are so many places that people can go.
Right.
Good-hearted people, they'll give a burrito that they just have, had half of. That really is not the issue. This isn't a grapes of wrath type of problem.
Right. And so they take the food and they do or don't eat it, and they throw it out onto the dump piles that are on either side of the encampments. And now we have a rodent problem on top of a homeless problem.
Oh, and it's out of control.
And I don't know if you know, in Southern California, it is really out of control. Where
it is. I was just there.
Yeah.
And you almost can't believe what you're seeing.
Yes.
Like, this can't be true. This has got to be a movie set. Doesn't make any sense.
And as a physician, what I keep telling everybody is, aside from the volatilized norovirus, which my son has already had norovirus twice from this, we're going to get from walking by the feces at the encampments or just on the street in San Francisco. We also have the fleas on the rodents carry rickettsial disease. And there's going to be major epidemics of flea vector-borne illnesses that get onto our pets, that get onto us, and tick-borne illnesses. They're going to be just massive. And it's going to have it's the way civilization works. It's the only reason humans have been able to congregate the way they have in cities is we had sanitation. And we literally, by allowing people to live sick in squalor, have had a complete breakdown of the basic functions of civilization.
I love what you just said, which is allow.
Yeah.
We have allowed it. And it's come under this heading of being compassionate. Well, I mean, what are we going to do? Where are we going to send them? Where are they going to go? What can we possibly do? And you're thinking, well, this isn't right.
Yeah.
We can't just let it go. That's not the option. What we have right now is not acceptable. We cannot allow it. And there are so many great things that can be done that aren't being done, and you end up in these battles with City Hall and nonprofit organizations and anybody else who wants to go into the ring and go, well, we just want to do this and you want to do that. And it becomes this quagmire.
There are simple things to do. You can expand conservatorship. So you can you can expand the definition of gravely disabled. And so people who are so sick and being ignored or stepped over or just left to in squalor on the streets can be brought into treatment. There's a friend of mine that works in the city council who went out and he got the ability to give showers to homeless. So he brought out these giant showers and started moving them around. He said on average to get one individual into a shower took 12 contacts. So the point being, because there's such severe mental illness, there's such severe distress, this is not about housing. And yet of course, housing is a piece of it, but the politicians keep harping on the housing part. Why is that?
Yeah, I actually sit on this on the board, the San Francisco Police Department's board on homelessness, and I'm with this group of people, and the Coalition on Homelessness is there, and we're going head to head, we're talking about it, and they say housing first, and I'm physically pounding my fist on the table here, and they're going, housing first, nothing else will do. We want supportive, wonderful, fantastic housing. Other, and if you don't have that, we won't accept anything. So this is what ends up happening, is that it's not a housing issue. You can't out-house addiction. You can't out-house mental illness.
Right.
You can't out-house somebody who doesn't actually want to be housed.
Right.
So the only thing that can be done is for the community to jump in.
Hang on. Those three categories, what percentage of homeless do you think would be represented by those three categories you mentioned?
I can speak to San Francisco. I think the primary one right now is, and unfortunately, this is good, there's a lot of overlap, but it really is drug addiction.
Okay, so it's addiction. Mm-hmm. It's drug addiction. I don't want housing or mm-hmm. severely mentally ill or some combination of those three.
Correct.
So that's what, 80%?
I would say that's a very fair assessment.
All right.
And what's really interesting, Drew, is that what you will often find is that you'll hear people who are, in city government, and they'll say things like, these are people who just lost their job.
Yeah, all the time.
Hey, evicted.
No,
and you're looking around going,
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
That's not what I'm seeing. That's not what I'm smelling. That's not what I'm touching.
I know. And there was an article, I think, in the LA Times this morning where a couple had been living in their car for 2 years and because they lost the job, blah, blah, blah. I said, no. Yes, the job loss and everything is a piece of it, but there's something neuropsychiatric going on with these people.
Yes.
That needs to be addressed and managed, or this is not going to get better. And people are in such massive denial about that, it drives me crazy, and people are suffering as a result. I don't understand it. I don't understand why we can't break through to give people that understanding. There, in Los Angeles, there are groups of little social work, I forget what they call themselves, they have little acronyms, sort of teams that are going out and having good, slowly eroding and getting people into treatment. But then again, where do you send them for treatment? There are no psychiatric beds. There's no long-term facilities. What are we going to do with that?
Yeah, I think the primary problem right now is that we can come down as much as we want and say, I'm an advocate for law enforcement. I work closely with them. I genuinely believe we need to enforce the laws, the sit-lie laws, the anti-encampments. We can't have it. But then you still are faced with that. What do we do?
Yeah.
Then what? And you're looking at these people who are so incapable of living in any sort of normal way that they need to have their hand held and taken to the next step.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what we don't have. Right? We don't have anybody doing that. We just have maybe somebody coming out going, you want a sandwich?
Yeah, no.
That's not going to help, dude.
No, not at all. It's a comprehensive, consistent relationship and a massaging in that relationship and the development of resources and teams. It's funny. I had a guy that recovered from homelessness call me one day and he goes, I know exactly what you guys should be doing. We need a place where you put people, four walls, a couple of beds, and there needs to be doctors and nurses and social workers, vocational rehabilitation specialists. I mean, that's a psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
It's exactly what's needed. It's precisely right. And then people can be brought back into the – and given a – and again, you need long-term management. You need ongoing maintenance. But we're just unwilling to look at that and blame the whole thing on housing. And I don't understand how it's going to get better. It's funny. In New York City, I was there last week, and it seemed quite a bit better. There's a on every subway, there's a phone number. You call if you see a homeless person struggling. We'll come get them. And,
yes.
And why can't we do that in other cities?
We can.
Okay.
But we truly do have to break through the resistance that is there, which is we get a lot of people who say, well, it can't be done, or it's complicated. And as soon as that is brought out into the conversation, then options start to dissipate. They just float away.
Yeah.
And so we really can't have that approach. I love that. I wanted to have in San Francisco billboards that say, look, if you see somebody in this state, call this number. If you see them in this type of a condition, call that number.
Yeah.
Get out there and do it. And
sure.
The resistance was ridiculous.
And by the way, when people get well and they get off the street and they get proper treatment, they look back and they're pissed. They're pissed at the people that let them sit out there like that. Who do you think they're helping? What is their problem?
You know, it's called selfish compassion. So you're feeling compassion for those people, for anybody who's on the street.
Narcissistic compassion.
Homelessness. Oh, it's completely negligent compassion.
Yeah, yeah.
My mother lived in her car with three of my siblings when I had, during a terrible financial period. So it's not like the compassion isn't there for people, you know, from me and from others who don't want this any longer. There's so much. My goodness, it's almost like, well, you know, who are you? Who are you to say these things?
So you haven't. Were been you there. One of the one lived in the car with her?
I was actually. My parents divorced when I was 17. So yeah. Then I left to go to college. I went to England to live for a while. At that stage, then everything just fell to ruin. And she had a beat up old station wagon, and three of my younger siblings wound up living in that car. And one of those siblings actually ended up being a heroin addict. So the effect, the ripple effect of that kind of poverty is intense. But they climbed out of it.
How did she get out of it? Sounds like she was depressed also.
And if somebody, without a doubt.
Yeah, so the depression, what sends them into immobility and inertia. Oh. It's not the whole. It's not the financial stuff exclusively. There's always these other neuropsychiatric phenomenon that put a capper on it, and make it unmanageable.
Oh, for sure. Networking. I know you agree with this too, which is the more social capital you have, the better.
Yep.
My mother is one of those people. She can't go into a supermarket without leaving a friend of somebody there.
That's nice.
And that's an inherent part of her personality, which helped her survive that terrible point in her life, which is you trust in others. You ask for help, you give help. You know, it's that bonding that you have with good, caring people, and that sense of like, I got to work my way out of this. I cannot live like this. You don't give up. And a lot of people do give up. And it's because, you know, you do have these other pressures that are going on. I mean, hey, let's face it. When my sister was a heroin addict, it was a bad, bad time. And I just talked to her the other day, and I'm like, Marsh, how did you do it? What happened? And I think we all kind of collectively went to her and pulled her by her hair, essentially, and said, this will not continue. This will not, we will not allow this.
I've seen a lot more aggressive interventions than that don't turn people around. Was she sort of willing and contemplative at that point?
She OD'd a couple of times before that, but it truly was I almost felt like that we came down like a herd of rhinoceroses on her. Like, we just won't stand around and let this happen.
And, is she in the program now?
Oh, she's been clean now for going on 15 years.
Does she have advice for people on the streets?
She does, and we talked a lot about it. And safe injection sites are a big buzzword these days. I don't know how you feel about it. I'm not a fan. She's on the edge, and we talked about it a lot. Like, would that have helped? And I think if my sister were still in her addiction, if she were still active in her, would I want her to go to a safe injection site? Would that be my wish for her? And I thought, actually, I'd rather her stay in the junkie house.
What if there were motivational specialists at the safe injection site that help get people from resistance to at least considering recovery?
If there were a way for them to be combined with, okay, now that we have you here, now let's really get you full force into recovery mode.
Well, that's usually that's the idea. I don't know that actually is executed that way, but it was originally, the model was originally drinking houses. People could go and drink as much as they want, but it's fully housed by recovering people and motivational specialists, and they have a very high rate of getting people from alcoholism to recovery in those wet homes. But I don't know that anyone's ever proven it for opiates. I don't know that.
Yeah, well, I mean, seriously, if the intention behind it and the execution truly was hey, now that you're here, let's get you into a recovery center. Let's get a substance abuse place out there for you right now. We'll get going. Then that would be on the upside for me. Yeah. The problem, of course, is crime. I talked to a lot of people in Vancouver where there is it was one of the first safe injection sites. And they had to have 60 additional police officers out there around the building to deal with the crime and the drug dealing. and the people who are passed out. It's been really tough. So we can say, yeah, it looks great on the inside, but on the outside, I got some problems with that.
I have a problem with the needle exchange programs. And that, well, I don't mind needle exchange. That's great. But needle giveaways is how you're ending up with the needles all over the streets.
They're everywhere.
Yeah.
I walk out, and I live in San Francisco in a nice neighborhood. I'm seeing needles everywhere. They're in front of playgrounds. They're in playgrounds. They're in parks. They're on the beach. They're washing up. They're washing into the bay in record numbers. I do blame. I got to say, sorry, Department of Health, but you know you're on my hit list. They hand them out like they are Skittles. Take them. Just take them.
Yeah, the exchange idea was a zero sum, right? Or at least one for two or something.
Yes.
But just handouts is how you end up with a real problem from a public health standpoint.
Yeah, so it's really dramatic.
How did you get involved? Is it because of your mom's homelessness that you got interested in all this?
You know, there were a lot of reasons. When I first moved to San Francisco, I think my first reaction was like dumbstruck with love. Like, this is... I fall in love with cities. I don't know what it is. Like, I fell in love with London. I fall in love with San Francisco. And when I started to see it take a really horrible downward turn, we've always had homelessness. Every city does. But when it started to get bad to the point of freakishness, and we have this wonderful cable car system. You go down to the cable car turnaround. It used to be this, like, charming place. And there are people passed out everywhere, ranting, raving, losing their minds, half naked, half dead. It got to the point now when I go to sleep at night, I think about it, and it plagues me. I'm just...
Yeah, I don't understand how people cannot do something about it. I'm with you on it.
Yeah. So that really was the start of it. And because of that, then I started to really get involved in city organizing, community organizing. I don't call myself an activist because that tends to kind of feel like I'm maybe in a lot, very left of center, which I'm not. I'm a gadfly. I really don't care. I'm not that, you know.
Yeah.
But I would say it's more of a protectionist. I want to protect the community. I get people all the time from the community, people who are visiting the city, people who are working here, going, this is breaking my heart.
Plus, when people come from other countries, it's baffling to them.
Oh, it's so baffling. Although I did hear that in London, their problem is getting quite a bit worse than I can even imagine. And, of course, Canada has a pretty serious problem as well.
What, with their perfect healthcare system? How could they possibly have a problem?
I know. For me, it was just a matter of love. It's kind of like you see a child, just like what we did with my sister, and kind of cradling in our arms and saying, yeah, we're not going to let this happen to you anymore. You know, it's done. It's over. And what I love, Drew, is that we are truly seeing a change. I am seeing more and more people going, yeah, I'm not going to believe this any longer. You're lying to me. I believe observational data. That person on the ground looks like they've been there maybe 3 years.
Yeah.
Not they. You know, they were housed last month, and now there they are.
Right.
So yeah.
Our politicians are failing these people and failing our communities so profoundly, and a lot of it is in California. To be fair, I mean, where things are just breaking down like you can't believe. I noticed last week when I was in New York, I felt such relief being in New York City. I thought, well, this is odd. It's just, when the homeless people are kind of on top of us, they're so few and there's something to be done about them as compared to California, where it's just spiraling out of control and just empty, lying rhetoric by the politicians.
Yes.
It's too much to believe.
And no accountability. Zero. Absolutely zero. So we flood money to the system. We have here... in this city, a $300 million annual budget. And what result? Zilch.
This is San Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah, in San Francisco. And, it just
is
goes
your
down
new
the
mayor?
Drain.
Is your new? I spoke to London Breed once, and she seemed like a rational person. Is she going to help you?
Well, it's interesting. London and I have, we don't agree on everything. And it's funny because we did go to the whole, like, my sister, her sister actually died of an overdose, and mine overdosed several times. Mm-hmm. And so we were kind of like head to head one day. We were talking about it, and Our conclusions were different. Now, this doesn't mean I don't respect her. I do. Actually, she's a very nice woman.
She was in favor of expanding conservatorship. She's in favor of that.
Because of that, I bow down to her for that.
Exactly.
But then I come back up again and I say, you got to be kidding me. You know, this is not what... So I genuinely believe that she is a lover of San Francisco as well. So, I'd love to... although I'm running for mayor in 2019.
Oh, congratulations. So. That's interesting.
Thank you. Yeah. It's almost more of a, look, just let me talk about these issues. Do I really want to be mayor?
I know. Right? Careful what you wish for. Well, if you like this show, then you must check out The Adam Carolla Show every weekday on Podcast One. The Ace Man still holds the title of the number one daily downloaded podcast in the world, and he complains about whatever is on his mind, and there's always something. Celebrity pals like myself, Joe Coy, many, many more, don't miss it. Weekdays on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. It is summer, which means Hydrolite, everybody. You could be exercising, lying on the beach, whatever it is, but you got to stay hydrated, and the simply best way to do so is with Hydrolite. Water itself does not do it. You need a proper balance of sodium, glucose, and water. Hydrolite does this better than any sports drink and certainly better than water alone. In fact, Hydrolite is the best oral hydration product I've ever tried. I wanted to invent exactly this myself. I had it in mind, and lo and behold, on comes Hydrolite, so I back them. Great flavors like orange, berry, lemonade, available as a pre-mixed drink or a powder. My personal preference is the effervescent tablets you simply drop in a glass of water or a bottle of water. And compared to sports drinks, Hydrolite delivers up to 4 times the electrolytes with 75% less sugar. The solutions at Hydrolite are appropriate for all ages, and each bottle or package includes easy-to-follow dosing instructions. You can find Hydrolite at Rite Aid or at Hydrolite.com. Again, that is HYDRALYTE.com/DRDREW/Dr. Drew. And for a limited time, our listeners get a 30% discount on Hydrolite. Just check the banner at DrDrew.com. Use the code DRDREW18 at checkout. That is Hydrolite.com/Dr. Drew, and then use that code DrDrew18. Well, maybe you're looking for a car. That's right. And you're probably familiar with terms like MSRP and dealer price and list price and invoice price and all these crazy things that are there, primarily confusing, let's be fair. But what you want is the price, what it actually is going to cost you. And that's why we have True Price from True Car. Now you can know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, before you ever even get to the dealership. True Car dealers will show you the true price on cars like the one you want, all from the comfort of your home. And how do you know True Price is a great price? Because True Car shows you what other people paid for the same car you want, and your True Car certified dealer knows this, and they set their true price competitively so they will win your business. So you'll learn all about the car, you'll learn all about the pricing in the area, and once you lock in that price, you're actually locking in a price for a real inventory, for an actual vehicle on a True Car certified dealer's lot. And of course, True Car is a place to buy your used cars as well. When you're ready to buy new or used, just visit True Car and you will enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features is not available in all states. So let's talk about your life in money and economics and whatnot. Now, what were you on Econ Top 4? What jumped out was the homeless stuff. I forget what you were talking about on the actual primary part of the podcast.
So Russ Roberts, who's phenomenal. I just love him. And obviously you do too. I was involved with a group called Downtown Streets Team, and there's actually a number of these types of organizations throughout the United States. But it's a nonprofit organization where any street person, and you could be as street as they get. In other words, curled up in a doorway for the past 10 years, never have, you know, the worst of the worst of the situation. They'll take you on. You go to the program. You sit through the meeting, you join a group that goes out to do city beautification programs, and you get a paycheck. Actually, it's in the form of a gift card. So it's this transitional way of jumping back into the work system. And I love the mission, which is dignity through work. That's what it is. And anybody can start. So that's why I was on the show, was I was talking about my involvement with them, but also the ideas about, you know, finances and, you know, personal responsibility. I'm a big personal responsibility person. You know,
it seems enough
of the excuses.
Well, right. It seems like we have gone through a phase when are sort of a psychological shift in this country where people expect things to be done for them or to them, and rather than the emotional growth and emotional satisfaction associated with doing something for yourself.
Absolutely, and it's a beautiful thing. Even before my parents divorced, the money was sort of going down and not doing so well. My dad was a gambler. Mm. So not only was he a terrible alcoholic, but he was a gambler. And money was in, and then it was out, and then it was in, and then it was out. Chaos was crazy. But because of that, my parents had seven children.
Oh.
we all had this, okay, well, we've got to take care of ourselves. We've got to babysit. We've got to mow lawns. We've got to pick up cans. We've got, you know. Yeah. And I think all of us really started working very early just because, you know, especially when you're a teenage girl, you know, you'd like some new clothes, thank you very much. And it's not going to come from mom and dad.
Do you have advice for parents about raising financially responsible kids?
Sure do.
Yeah.
My first one is really be careful. Let's start at the beginning. Don't have kids that you can't financially take care of if you possibly can.
I don't think people even know what you're talking about when you say that anymore.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It really starts there, which is think, for goodness sakes, they are expensive. Even if you could be a great parent, but it costs money, and you can be a great parent and it doesn't cost so much, but you've got to plan ahead. You've got to think about it. And most people just don't. It's just, I want a baby.
Yes.
Pregnant. So it really starts there. And I'm a huge advocate for early work. And I love this. I remember when my daughter, who's now 15, when I would leave for work, she was just a little baby at that time, little toddler and then on up. And I would say, I'm going to work. I'm so excited. Which sounds really cheesy, but I always thought, if I do that, she'll get this idea that work is really great. And even when I'm like, I'm going to work, I'm very tired, but I have to, and I'm really glad that I'm paying the bills. So, again, it sounds kind of, like, ridiculous, but if you can just instill that passion for taking care of yourself, for being self-sufficient, it's one of the best things you possibly can do, and it doesn't take anything to say that.
What other advice do you have generally for people? In other words, what's occupying you these days in terms of people's financial health? What keeps you up at night?
What keeps me up at night, I would say, is despondency. Mm. Thinking that you can't survive with what you have or that there is not going to be a better tomorrow.
I get that a lot,
especially when it comes to debt.
Well, now, talk about that, because Adam and I were talking about that the other day, and we were hearing from particularly middle-aged white men that sort of weird lack of spark, lack of inspiration, and a feeling of being it's discriminated against, frankly. That's sort of part of it. They're being told that they're privileged white men, and they're responsible for everything bad in the world, and that they don't deserve anything, and so they're starting to believe it. And start to really get, I wouldn't call it depressed, but sort of withdrawn. They're afraid to talk to females for fear of being misconstrued. There's just this constant feeling of worthlessness that we're seeing in even 20-year-old males.
That's so tragic.
Yeah.
It really is so tragic. And I certainly hope that this is going to be a little tiny sliver in time where that's how people are feeling.
It's been worsening for the last couple of years. It's pretty straight line of misery in that vein.
I think the key to happiness, if you want to kind of look at it from that approach, is to contribute, to step back and
agreed.
To realize that you are really kind of part of this world and that you're doing something really good, but also to enjoy that process. And hope. You've got to have hope. I can't instill that in somebody, but I can say, you could pay that debt off. You can work harder. You can tell that person who's telling you can't do it to F off. You can, you know, it's remarkable about what people can do once they get started, but you know it's that inertia, right? It's that, like, you just can't get off the couch.
It's the inertia, but it's there's something sort of systemic going on now, too,
mm-hmm.
where – you know, people of profound abilities are being told, "Nah, you're white male. You need not apply," and just sort of not only need not apply, but you're responsible for everything that's going wrong in the world. So just get at it, scram, and they start to internalize that feeling. I hear a lot from these young males, And then you say, well, give back, be part of it, have it, get a social life. And they go, well, I can't really talk to women because they might – they're misconstrued. You know, they're going to accuse me of something and I'm scared of that. And so it's an interesting time to be a male. It really is.
I would think so. And I think that we overthink these things a lot too, which is like, do I really have to – I was watching some movie, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember this is, I was thinking, this is such a perfect microcosm of what the times is. The young male character said to the woman, I'm thinking about kissing you. Would it be okay if I kissed you?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, what lunacy is this?
Oh, yeah. Well, now not only is that now the way it works, but then you have to have paperwork. You have to sign a consent.
We don't want that. But on the flip side, I do. My daughter is stunning, and I just went to Southern California with her, and you know, I was noticing that there's a certain amount of prey that you are when you're a beautiful young woman. Mm-hmm. And I even remember walking down the street in North Beach here in San Francisco, and I was holding your hand. We were having a great time, just having a lark, and this 40-something-year-old man leans out of the car, and he said something so lewd. I was holding her hand. Yeah. And I was thinking, that's the kind of stuff that we need to deal with.
That's
you know?
It's not as though there still isn't a problem. That's the conundrum.
Well, yeah. And so, look, I don't care. You get this excitement to go, you know, kiss the girl that you're on a date with. Go for it, dude. But there's no reason to lean out. In fact, it's horrible. Don't lean out of a car window and start screaming something obscene at a girl who's, you know, clearly underage and holding her mother's hand.
Oh, my God. It's just too much.
But maybe that's a reaction, though, isn't it, where people do feel like they're so – white men might feel that they're so – their arms are connected to their waist and they can't move so much and they just kind of blah.
It's pretty – that's unusual. But let's go back to the finances. Mm-hmm. So we live in a time – the other sort of wind that's blowing is this sort of democratic socialism, whatever that is.
God.
Any thoughts about that?
Yes. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And, you know, I truly hope that it is a – I truly hope that most people will be able to see through it very quickly. And, you know, people get caught up in this whirlwind and in the excitement of something new. Okay, fine. Let's have something else that's new. Not that. That's not going to work. It's not good for the United States. It's not good for anybody. Let's just leave that alone. Thank you very much for your thoughts. You know, no, I think it's just terrible. And, you know, I'm very conservative in some ways when it comes to finances, both personal and political, very social, as regarding, you know, social issues. I'm very liberal, but not that.
How do we inspire people to get into the system, the economy, and to sort of let the invisible hand do its work and be a part of some dynamism that would help things grow?
You know, I think we all start to need to question how much. God, now I'm really going to sound like a conservative. But how much money that we do spend in the government for things and organizations and departments that do not do anything at all. And so once you start doing that, you can apply it to your own life as well, which is like, really, what am I spending my money on? Is it doing something for me? Am I getting enough out of it? And if you start to think like that, you really start to make some positive changes. In other words, let's just say that you go to an amusement park and you drop with your family and you drop $600. I'd like people to go back home and think, well, was that worth it?
That's a crazy amount of money. Just go to an amusement park, isn't it?
Well, Disneyland these days.
Yeah, I know.
You know, but to question it, like, really, is that worth it? Is that worth the cost, worth the expense, worth all my time that it took to earn that money or put it on the credit card? Now I'm going to pay interest on it. Be a lot more personal and analytical about it. Just step back. This is, you know, you work hard for your money. I work hard for my money. Why is it that people will work for their money and then fritter it away? It all goes away. I don't understand it. And that's something that I would really love a revolution about, which is for goodness sakes, think before you do. Just a little bit. It doesn't have to be crazy, but just a little.
If you were a young person today just starting out, what would you do? What do you think has the greatest potential, and what training would you get? And that's like your top three.
Okay.
Because a lot of people are trying to figure that out right now, and it seems like such a moving target. And there's a lot of following your muse or whatever, but it's there's got to be some things that are more likely to bear fruit than others.
Well, I definitely think that to dive into work as soon as possible and start saving money and start to love that feeling of saving money,
mm-hmm.
Just to really, really enjoy that process of moving it from one hand to the next.
Growth.
It's a freaking gorgeous feeling. Yeah. I mean, it you get addicted to that feeling of like, oh my God, now I'm really doing it. And then you start to change your financial habits after that. But when it comes to work, and this is something that's really critical, is stop talking to your employer or potential employer about what you want. The best advice I can give to anybody out there who's looking for a job, wants to excel, is really focus on what they want. What is it that they're looking for? If I'm going to hire somebody who's going to help me with an article or whatever it is, I want them to come to me and say, hey, Erica, I want to help you with your work. What would you like me to do? I could do this, I could do that, and that. But I don't want them to say, that really makes me feel good to sit and work with you, Erica, and I'm really loving it. I've always wanted to be an editor. Like, I don't really care what you want.
Oh,
so start switching it around. Be that person that is that invaluable person, that they're the ones. I would like a young person to really get into that habit as well, which is, okay, what can I do to help that person? I want to be invaluable. That's what you want. And that's really cool. And start small, for goodness sakes. You've heard this a thousand times probably, but it's this idea that you're gonna start big. You're gonna be a DJ and you're gonna play in Ibiza.
And
gonna earn, right? Just be okay. I listen to Adam Carolla as well and a lot, as well as your podcast, and the whole get out there and dig a ditch.
Yeah. Yeah.
Minimum wage is fine. I'm a huge Grapes of Wrath fan.
I've noticed that the millennials are pretty good at working hard and getting in, but then they're very impatient and expect to move up very quickly. Like, well, okay, I've done my time. Let's go. Time for me to be a vice president.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. And the fact is that you may not ever make a huge amount of money. So figure out how you're going to use the money that you do have in a positive way. So invest it, buy real estate. I don't care what it is that you do, but it may not come from that job. It could come from your side hustle. It could come from some other way of doing things.
But if you were advising someone to study something, what field of mm-hmm. it, let's say they didn't have any specific interest, but they were super smart, and you'd say, well, why don't you study this? I hope you're not going to say computer programming, because that just seems too.
Are you kidding?
Yeah.
Okay, here's a little secret. I was actually an art history major.
Okay.
And I loved almost every moment of it. And I'm thrilled that I did it. So the humanities, the liberal arts, love it. It's so valuable to be that person who can be critical in a really great way. And you learn that in college. And if you don't go to college, fine, you don't have to, but you could learn it on your own. But, so if you do pursue a higher education, for goodness sakes, get something out of it that's going to help you discern between truth and fiction, and that you want, here's another one, is that be polite too. We have lost our sense of civility.
Mm.
Listen to somebody, listen without judgment, for at least for a moment. I like judgment, but give them some time. And don't scream and yell and protest because somebody's got a different perspective than you. It's totally fine. If somebody doesn't want to believe in human-affected climate change or, is a big fan of, some conservative speaker, learn to shrug it off. Like, it's not a big deal. People can have differences of opinions and just kind of love it. Love that fact.
or listen to them so you can understand how their brains work, or maybe even change your own mind. Who knows? I mean, that's it's better.
Yeah, that echo chamber is pretty alive and well.
Better to be accurate than to be right.
Exactly.
So you would not – any particular field of – well, would you advise people to be an expert in something?
You have to find that balance between your passion, you know, something that really is driving you, and if you want to be a marine biologist and that's what you want to go, great, and practicality. You know, philosophy is lovely, though I hated it. I think that was one of the few classes I think I had to drop out before I did get an F in it. It was really hard. But there is a certain amount of practicality as well. At least kind of think ahead a little bit. Okay, like if I studied art history, what else can I do with it? How can I parlay this into something really positive for my long-term growth? And anything could be done, you know, almost anything. So I would say, as far as a major, don't just go for the STEM, which was being pushed on everybody, which makes me want to vomit. If I had to go back to college and study computer programming, I may as well just pack my life in. seriously, I wouldn't have been able to do it. I would have loathed every moment of my life, and it probably would have carried through until today. So that's just not the way to go. Especially, it really bugs me when people say things like, well, you know, girls need to enter those fields. If they want to. Enough of this pushing it into that direction.
Where'd you go to school?
I started at San Diego State, and then I went to the University of London, and then I ended up at San Francisco State.
And did you study any particular – there? Did you like any particular part of art history? Was there some specialization?
Yeah, I actually really loved African art.
Oh, and interesting.
And I especially love the transition period. So it would be, the pure African art that you had. And then, here comes the Portuguese influence. And so you could see this amazing transition from one type of art to the next. And it was really beautiful to do. So, I mean, was it practical? No, but here I am today.
Right.
So I think that... Yeah, go ahead.
I agree. I do feel the way you do. I'm always afraid that maybe I'm Pollyannish a little bit about liberal arts, but I believe a good liberal arts education helps you think and express yourself and read and write and think analytically and carefully. And if you're sort of, you know, really well trained, doesn't matter what you study, and you know, then what you do with it is up to you.
One of my absolute – I had two favorite classes in college. One was linguistics, which really blew my mind. Like it was this idea that language and your brain is so interconnected that we can never truly understand each other unless we learn the language or at least make an attempt to learn the language. And sometimes we may not even – understand each other anyway. There are some words just simply are not translatable, like my favorite word of all, which is sisu, which is Finnish, meaning this courage in the face of odds that you will never beat. And there is no word for it in the English language. But, you know, that was a great class, and you probably only get that in college. And then the other one was debate. Oh, my gosh, I love debate. Love it. And I think everybody should take a debate class, a formal debate class.
Seems like a good idea, frankly. I'll have to go back and study it. All right. And before I wrap this up, anything else on the expecting money, the essential financial plan for new and growing families in the book, things you want people to sort of understand are in there?
You know, I just want people to understand that these are issues that doesn't take a lot to prepare, but it will not happen on its own. So take a step back, do a little bit of budgeting, do a little bit of planning, do as much, buy it cheaply as much as you possibly can and expensively on the occasional thing. And really, having a baby is enjoy it. You don't have to spend a lot in order to enjoy the process. And raise your kids with a money smart attitude, which is, enjoy work and really emphasize the power of being self-sufficient. It's a beautiful thing.
Well, I appreciate it, Erica Sandberg. We've had a sort of a far-reaching conversation from homelessness to autonomy, and I appreciate you coming in, and I hope I had even close to as much fun as you had on Econ Talk, because I had fun listening to you. It's at Erica J. Sandberg. You can follow her there. You can go to ericasandberg.com, and we'll look forward to your mayoral run. Was that what you were going to do in 2019?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Do they do a mayor every 3 years up there? Wait a minute.
Well,
oh, it's because it was a special election. That's right. Oh, my God.
Yes. Oh. So it's a bizarre time. So but, yeah, come on over to San Francisco. See me. It's a great city. Sorry about the needles.
I feel like it's sort of starting to move in the right direction. I feel like as you said, the people aren't the empty rhetoric is not being accepted any longer, and people are sort of finding solutions on their own, not even necessarily with the government, and certainly not with the government rhetoric. They're just saying, just shut up. We're going to go try to take care of this problem. And in Los Angeles, we have lots of money now being dedicated to it. As long as they keep the clinical side properly funded, it will kind of go okay, I suspect. Mm-hmm. All right, Erica, thank you so much. I appreciate you spending some time with me.
Thank you. Bye. Right,
bye-bye. Take care. And that about does it. We'll see you all next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.